Picture the scene, if you will. You're all alone in a vast landscape of rolling hills. The valley below where you stand is covered by a dark, menacing blanket of conifers. It's late afternoon, and you've been riding your bike all day, on narrow lanes, across farm fields, along forest tracks, and down rocky paths. You spent the last hour alternately riding, pushing, dragging, and cursing your bicycle as you made your way across a huge featureless plateau of peat bog and grassy hummocks. You're splattered with mud. Your bike is splattered with mud. Your belongings are crammed into bulging nylon pods strapped to your bike, and they are splattered in mud. As you wiggle your toes, you feel a watery squelch. Before long, it'll be getting dark, and you'll need to find a place to take shelter for the night. You'll unfurl your bivy bag, rummage around for something to eat, crack open a tin of sardines, and spoon them down with a bowl of couscous cooked on a meths burner you've made from an old Coke can. As the daylight drains from the sky, and the last clouds drift away over the horizon, you'll lie back on your damp, grassy bed, and look up as the evening stars twinkle into life. You'll think back to the places you've been and all that you've seen along your way to this wild and beautiful spot. Snuggling deeper into your sleeping bag and pulling the hood tight around your head, you close your eyes and fall asleep. You wake with the dawn chorus and the dim light of a new day, brew a cup of tea, wring out your wet socks, and get back on the bike. Welcome to the Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. This week on the show, we'll be taking a look at bikepacking. Is it the most exciting thing in cycling since the invention of the mountain bike? Or a much-needed rebranding of the venerable pastime of cycle touring? Or could it be just another cynical ruse to get us to buy more stuff? An attempt to commercialise that wonderful thing called adventure. Well, I hope that by the end of the show, you'll be in a better position to make up your own mind. One of the epicentres of British bikepacking is deep in the badlands of Mid Wales, and not a million miles from where I live in the Black Mountains. From his rustic lair in the Pennant Valley, Stuart Wright tests out new bikepacking gear, runs an online bikepacking forum with nearly 1,000 members, and puts on regular bikepacking events. These range from competitive, timed challenges to more relaxed, turn-up-and-ride jamborees, all under the flag of bare-bones bikepacking. To find out what the bikepacking buzz was all about, I rode last year's bare-bones winter event. It was almost a year ago, and the recordings I made, well, I thought that they were lost, but I've recently unearthed them in a muddy, rain-soaked corner of my hard drive. Better late than never, I guess. Well, the weekend began with tea and toast at the school canteen in Llanbryn Mire. It was here that I asked Stuart to tell me what lay in store for me.
Ford Fiesta. It's the fourth year of the Bare Bones Winter event. This one is going to take everybody towards various fords throughout Mid Wales. Some people get wetter than others. Some people spend the night outside. Some people probably spend the night in bothies. There's going to be a few people, unfortunately, spend the night in a B&B or the occasional pub. Weather forecast doesn't look brilliant, even though it does look like it might get slightly better throughout the day. But at the end of the day, your skin's waterproof. You're not made of salt. You won't melt. Hopefully, everybody will have a good time.
So how many people are riding today?
I think we had about 93 enter. I imagine by the time we finish, there'll probably be 80 go out, something like that, I'd have thought. Hopefully 80 will return.
And so the way you've set it up is there's no prescribed route. You've sent out a bunch of grid references. I think to do everything, to go around every waypoint that you've set would involve almost 200 kilometres of riding. Most people are going to choose their own route and have their own fun, right?
Yeah, the idea is that people get to choose their own route. There's no hard or fast rules. They can go wherever they want to go. Everybody's different. There's no right, there's no wrong. You just go wherever you like.
Do you think that's what bikepacking is about? It's not primarily a competitive cycling pursuit.
It's non-competitive at all, really. You've obviously got racers. You know, you've got the ITTs in this country, in Europe, predominantly in the US. But at the end of the day, it's about getting out. It's about riding your bike. That's the thing. You know, it's a journey at the end of the day. I'm glad to say I think people are now discovering that riding your bike can take you on a journey. It's not just a toy to spend 2 hours lapping around a trail centre. You can go somewhere, you can experience sights, sounds that you've never seen before on your back door, really.
And any last tips for me as I head out? My bike's loaded up with stuff. I got my bivy bag and my tarp and a sleeping bag. How am I going to stay comfortable and alive?
Everybody can survive a night out. The majority of people, even if they weren't carrying anything, would be all right for 24 hours. Try and keep your feet dry. That's the best advice. If you can keep your feet dry, I'm getting smirks out now, like, that's impossible. But if you can keep your feet dry, chances are you'll be all right. Find somewhere out of the wind.
It's a full fiesta. You might get wet. Hope you don't. But if you do, there's a towel.
Thank you very much.
And a Ford Fiesta wouldn't be the same without its fluffy dice.
Perfect. Thank
and
you.
A bar of chocolate to help you on your way when you're feeling low. Okay, see you tomorrow for some more cake.
Look forward
and more
to
tea. All right, bye.
Wade in the water. Wade in the water. Children, wade in the water. He's gonna trouble the water. He's gonna trouble the water.
Wade in the water.
Wade in the water. Wade in the water. He's gonna trouble.
Well, I'm through the gate and finally off road after a little lane start. Quite an steep uphill climb where I passed a gentleman who was pushing his bike and was pretty sure that he'd had enough, even though he'd travelled only about a mile and a half since the start, and sounded very disappointed. Was Andy from Stafford. His reasoning was that he was just carrying far too much stuff. He'd given in to that temptation to buy all the different bike packing bags and fill them to the brim and load them up on his bike, and as a result his bike was just far too heavy for the terrain around here. But I do wonder if I've done the same thing myself. Looking around at the start in the car park, there seem to be a lot of people who are travelling pretty light. So this is now an exceptionally muddy bridle path that I'm riding along, which is part of the Glendower Way long distance footpath. But at this point, it is open to people on bikes. And it's not so much the rain, although there are some rain clouds around, and when I set off, it was into a shower of hail. It's more the wind. The wind is this block headwind coming from the west, the tail end of the storm that passed through overnight, dumping all the rain that is filling the rivers. I can see quite a few bike tracks in the mud here, which suggests that there are other people who have come this way too. Now, the track has essentially become some kind of river. Oh dear. I'm not sure I'm going to manage to keep my feet dry for the whole of this weekend. But another gate. And on we go.
See that a horse all dressed in red. He's gonna trouble the water. Must be the children and the
Well, that rushing sound is the sound of my first Ford in the Ford Fiesta. A little hilly route up down into the Dubby Valley and then across over to the other side. And the good news is that Andy from Stafford has persisted and decided to carry on. And he's going to follow a route mostly on the lanes, which is probably very wise. But he's not packing. I guess he warmed up on that long climb at the beginning and decided that he'd come all this way from Stafford and was going to keep riding. So that's good news. Well done, Andy. So now looks like an ascent through some woods on a bridleway track that is essentially a stream. Well, here goes. The bike is already exceptionally muddy and I'm starting to feel a bit of moisture in my toes, which is a bad sign after about only an hour of riding. But there we go. Well, things have just got rather real. I'm about four fords in and it's beginning to get pretty cold and very windy, and I've just hauled my bike up a tussocky field, enormous tussocky field, with a gradient of about 25%, slipping all over the place in the mud. Some kind of aeroplane flying overhead. I don't know if that's mountain rescue. But just around the corner at the top of what I thought was the crest, to see another massive push climb ahead of me. I imagine there's a glorious sunset, but I'm on the wrong side of the hill right now. And I guess there's about an hour of twilight left, and then it'll be time to turn on the lights and see how I get on riding through the dark.
Now, I have to interrupt things to explain that the events that followed were never recorded, at least not on my recorder. They do remain seared in my memory. It got dark, and then it started to snow. I joined up with a small group of other riders, and pretty soon we had to ford a deep, fast-running stream. To do this, one of us stood on each bank of the stream and another sat astride a log in the middle, handing the bikes across. If you want to see it, I did take a photograph, which you can find on the website. After that came the bonk. For the next 10 miles, I was barely able to keep up with the other riders, let alone talk into a recorder. Eventually, we arrived at a pub, and refreshed by hot food, warm beer and an open fire, we rode back up the mountain, fording our last pair of streams for the day before making camp.
Well, it's morning on the Sunday morning, and shortly after my moment of hell and despair on that long push, I was passed by another rider riding a single-speed bicycle, John. We stuck together for the rest of the... that was basically evening by then, wasn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. And sampled the delights of the local pub for
that was your
bit
call.
Of sustenance. Yeah,
that was a very good call, I have to say, because I was beginning to lose faith, really. And then we had that long descent from the Nantymoch Reservoir down to the pub, and a good hour and a half getting warmed up and dried out there.
Indeed, and a little climb on the way back up just to test those newfound calories. And finally found a nice spot to be.
So we're standing in now, just getting things packed up after a hell of a windy night. I mean, we're in a stand of trees that's within a kind of stone-walled enclosure, but we're really right up in the uplands here. It's very windy, as you can probably hear. But we didn't know that this place existed, and there were a couple of other folks who live around here in the pub who said you might give this place a go. And luckily we were able to follow their directions and find it. And it was actually, I mean, what of a godsend of a place. It wasn't so windy. This would be absolute paradise for mountain camp out.
Absolutely. It's as bivvy spots go, it's pretty good. There's a almost permanent fire pit, which would have been good if the wind wasn't so strong. And some good shelter. It's a good spot.
And so what kind of ride have you got planned for today? I think I know what I'm doing.
it could be much the same as me. I had a difficult day yesterday. So I think, obviously, we're off-road at the moment. We'll do the first however many miles, maybe through a bit of woodland. When I hit a little minor road, I'll see how my legs are, but I might head back to the start, I think.
We should pass by Glaslyn, which is a beautiful upland lake, and that maybe will be the sort of high point aim for.
Yeah.
that's cool and clear. My best friend thinks I'm a drip. He buys a drink and he sips and sips. Then he starts to run his lip. So give me water without the nip.
Give me water, water. Give me water, water.
Don't give me that stuff that makes me high. Just give me water, that old standby. Folks in town, they won't champagne. But I think it's a doggone shame. Everywhere I go, I'm offered a drink. So give me water and let me think.
Give me water, water. Give me water, water.
Don't give me that stuff that makes me high. Just give me water, that old standby.
We're back at base. I've had some toast, cup of tea, cake, and I feel refreshed and wonderful. But there were some difficult moments. How do you feel that the event has gone for all the people that you've seen coming back today?
I mean, generally, everybody seems to have had a good time. Various amounts of miles covered, various amounts of stories. Most people who come to...
What's the best story?
I'm not sure if there's actually one that stands out as such. I suppose one of the nice things is that most people have survived it and they've got back reasonably dry. That was, for most people, going to be the sort of the big bugbear, if you like, of the weekend. Given the weather forecast, it could have been horrendous.
Well, it was good that the rain fell in solid form. I felt that that was helpful to our cause. I don't normally feel that, oh, great, hail, yes.
Yeah, hail and snow, far better than driving rain, without a doubt. It's not the sort of event that people would do necessarily as a first-time event. That tends to be more well-tried thing than anything else, given the weather and the potential for it being nasty. But it kickstarts people's year. It gets you off the settee after the sort of indulgences of the festive season and gives you a reason to ride. That's what it comes down to. It's an excuse to escape sort of normality for a bit, I suppose. And as I say, sort of recover from Christmas, New Year, and all the turkey.
Taking a longer view of bike packing, because you've been involved in the scene for a number of years now, how do you think it's changed and where do you think it's going in this country?
It's evolved massively, very quickly. One of the biggest changes really has been sort of the capability for carrying things. 5-6 years ago, everybody was using rucksacks. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, hang on, there might be a better way of doing this. And as luggage has developed, it's almost gone hand in hand with distances getting longer. And also then people have started to use a lot more of the technology that's drifted down from ultralight backpacking. So if you look at what people are carrying now to what they were 5 years ago, it's generally a lot less, but comfort hasn't suffered because of it. I think also bike manufacturers are now starting to see that there's a potential market. So people are starting to look towards bikes that, while not specifically bike packing, lend themselves to bike packing.
So what kind of bike would that be?
It tends to be rigid 29ers, if I'm perfectly honest, which primarily people tend to ride anyway, just from a simplicity point of view. And the potential for weight saving. People like Genesis, Salsa, obviously. You know, Salsa is sort of almost now are a bikepacking company, if you like, or certainly adventure cycling company. But I don't think it'll be long before some of the sort of, you know, the big, very big manufacturers, maybe Specialized, maybe Giant, start to produce things that they'll push towards that side of the market. I can see it becoming more popular. I can see.
Has it become more popular? Has your entry for these kind of events gone up?
Oh, yeah. If you consider the very first Welsh Ride thing, we had 11 people. Last year, we had 150 plus. So it is. It's getting bigger. The only thing which you sort of do notice, if you like, the pattern to it, is the age. It's not something generally that seems to appeal to younger riders, even though, you know, this weekend we've had younger riders sort of 17, 18. But generally, people tend to be sort of mid-30s plus. There doesn't seem to be any sort of upper age limit. You know, you've got people riding 60s, 70s, and getting out there and doing the same as everybody else is.
And does it seem to be quite a... I mean, cycling always struggles with being overwhelmingly, at least in this country, a male thing. Is that the same thing for... I mean, certainly on this winter event, the Ford Fiesta, it's definitely been more Gary than Sharon.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. I mean, we do have women... who come, but a small percentage, you know, probably, if I'm honest, less than 5%. It'd be nice to see more women out there. There's no reason why they shouldn't, you know. I think because it's not competitive generally, you know, the whole thing isn't competitive, bar the ITTs, then I'm surprised there aren't more women out there. I'd say to them, just give it a go, you know, get out there, try it. You don't have to go far. You can have an adventure within 10 miles of your doorstep. You know, don't consider you've got to go and ride 300 miles and you're only going to get 2 hours of sleep. At the end of the day, you could have 12 hours of sleep and you could ride 3 miles, but you'll still have had a similar adventure, even if it isn't the same adventure.
I was riding the Bare Bones Bikepacking Winter event, and you can find out more about future events on the Bare Bones website. One of the things I really like about bikepacking is that it seems to be a very friendly bunch of people doing it. I think there must be something about shivering away in a bivy bag or sharing a bothy with a half dozen snoring strangers that discourages the prima donnas and the fashionistas that you'll occasionally find in other cycling subcultures. And another thing I like about bikepacking is how much of the kit that's been developed over the last few years has been done in a really small-scale, homespun way. And there's no better example of this than Wildcat Gear. I went down the road to Brecon to meet Beth Barrington, who founded the company and still runs it from her spare room.
And here we are in Wildcat Gear, and let's describe what we see. This looks like a room in a house.
Yes, basically. It's our spare room. We're planning on getting out and getting ourselves an office as soon as we can. But at the moment, we're still based at home, and it's slowly taken over almost the entire house. But, you know, it's here, we're working, and if you've seen any of our gear, you'll know that we're churning out some really nice gear at the moment.
Well, we'll come to the gear in a minute, but let's just describe the scene. There's a couple of sewing machines in front of us, and a load of cardboard boxes, and some rolls of material all stacked up. It's very neat and tidy.
Yeah, I got OCDs, or CDOs, depending on how you look at it. But I've got three different machines. You've missed the Pride and Joy in the corner there.
Oh, well, this is the one in the wooden box.
This is the one in the wooden box. This was originally purchased by my great aunt Florence
in
1905.
That. So that's kind of black and gold lacquered.
It's an original treadle faff, for those who know really, really retro sewing machines. I've now got it on a Singer treadle. They'd be heartbroken to know I couldn't get hold of an original faff. But yeah, it's over 100 years old, and it's a hand treadle, and all the custom frame bags and all the custom gear has the labels done by that machine, and it's set up exclusively just to do all the beautiful little Wildcat logos.
So is this the machine that you started off on?
Pretty much, yeah. This was my only sewing machine until I started making bags for other people, and my original frame bag was done on that machine.
So what prompted you to start making bikepacking kit?
Well, we've always biked. I've been biking since I was 15, so, you know, over half my life now. And when sort of the what you see as the modern development of bikepacking happened, you just couldn't get the in-the-frame bags, which are now so synonymous with bikepacking. You had to import them from America at quite a great expense. And my other half knew I was sort of a dab hand at sewing. I'm sort of quite a crafty person, you know. So he sort of said, you know, do you think you can do this? So it started with a cutout of a freebie duffel bag that we had, and he rode that, and then we bought some more material. And one of the original races that he did 140 miles or something on a homemade frame bag, and somebody saw it and went, I want one of those. So I made it for one of his mates, and then I made it for another friend of his. And Kevin, who had my second ever bag, did the Tour Divide in 2011. At that point, I knew that I was onto a winner. You know, we then started developing the website and more products, and basically it went from there, and it's just snowballed.
Well, let's take a little step back here and talk about the challenges of carrying stuff on a mountain bike, because if you're carrying stuff on a touring bike, you traditionally do that with racks made out of aluminium or steel if you're going super durable, on the back, so above the back wheel and around the front wheel on this kind of low rider type of thing. You might have a handlebar bag that's clamped to the handlebars, or you might have a saddle bag on the back
kind of Caradice style saddlebag on the back. Bikepacking is completely different, isn't it, really? What are the challenges of carrying stuff on a mountain bike?
With bikepacking, I mean, you're tending not necessarily for going for the incredibly long distances, sort of the sort of cross continents and things like that, and you're taking stuff to a minimum. So you're packing, to a certain extent, less luxuries at home. But you're also trying to avoid, essentially, the panniers and the very, very big, heavy fat end, because as soon as you start putting the racks on, you're adding weight, and then the bags tend to be bigger, heavier, bulkier, so you're adding an awful lot of weight. You know, anybody that's toured with a touring bike knows, you know, you can't get it off the floor, let alone lift it over a locked gate. And, you know, crossing a ford, anything like that, the bike packing essentially is slimming that down to running a variety of different styles of frame bags which run in the main triangle of the bike. And then rather than having heavy racks on the front, we've developed the Mountain Lion harness that basically fits onto the handlebars. And you basically strap a dry bag, anything up to 20 litres, onto the front handlebars of your bike, and therefore, you know, reducing the drag while riding. And on the back, you can have a seat pack that attaches underneath the saddle, which basically avoids the great big fat back end, which when you're riding on the road doing long distances isn't an issue. But if you're mountain biking and you want to do single track, tight, twisty trails, basically simplifying the gear means you can enjoy all those trails that you'd strip all your gear off and go whizzing around and, you know, really, really enjoying, but still carrying the gear, and then keep going in camp and then repeat the next day.
It's quite interesting, because if you look back at the very early history of people travelling by bicycle, a lot of what they have on their bikes, so this is like in the 1890s, is very similar to what bikepacking is in terms of luggage. You've got a big roll on the handlebars. You've not got racks and panniers and that kind of thing. And often you might have a frame bag as well. It's quite strange that it's sort of come full circle with this sort of cutting edge of mountain bike luggage technology is actually very much like what there was in the 1890s.
Yeah, when I was researching for the first frame bag that I made, I Googled what was available, and we found the sort of big producers in North America. But then we also found a whole pile of images of people, as you say, in the, you know, at least part of the 20th century, with homemade frame bags in their bikes, and, you know, essentially road bikes with that big frame geometry that gave you loads and loads of space, and they just filled it, you know. And people have always been strapping stuff to their handlebars. You know, people still go to the races with bungee cords on their handlebars, but we've just developed products that mean A, your gear is safe and secure, but also your bike is more safe and secure.
In terms of distributing weight around the bike, are there any rules that you should follow?
Contrary to what most people think, actually keeping the weight over the handlebars works quite well. If you keep it over the seat, A, because it's so high up against the centre of gravity, that can destabilise your bike quite a bit. So actually keeping it over the front, it can make the handlebars feel a little bit sluggish till you get used to it. It's not what people think, that it's going to throw you over the handlebars, because it's not forward of your front axle. So it actually helps to keep your bike rooted to the trail. And I mean, I'm tiny, I'm 5'4", I weigh very, very little. And when I ride, I can't get my front wheel on the ground. If I lose traction, it's usually on the front wheel rather than the rear. So in actual fact, having the weight over the front actually keeps it more stable. Whereas if it's loads over the back, you run the risk of lifting the front up, which is something that I really notice. Running most of the weight over the front, you know, you can be quite clever about the way you pack. If you're packing a pan, don't just pack a pan as a single unit. Pack your pan with your sleeping bag stuffed inside. Therefore, you have no dead space. You know, and the same can be done with, you know, smaller pans, down jackets, you know, even to the point that, you know, you can buy tiny stoves nowadays, the size of almost like big whiskey bottle lids. But, you know, you don't just pack those. You have your matches in a thing inside, you know, and really utilising every space that you've got.
And then in terms of choosing materials, have you had to do a lot of testing? How did you make sure that the materials you were using were hard wearing and aren't going to give out after a couple of years? Have you chosen the right materials?
We've deliberately picked materials that are in excess of what we think most people would use, and we have had them, or we are having them tested, we are developing them, we are, you know, researching what's available, we are finding out what's available, contacting new suppliers, different suppliers to source different materials all the time, you know, just to make sure that, you know, people are happy with what they get.
And given that there are a number of small companies and a couple of big companies making this kind of stuff, and you're all sort of in the same area, you know, as we described, the sort of the three mounting points, is there much intellectual property theft going on, industrial espionage? Have you patented these things? Are you able to patent these things? How can you retain what you've learnt as, you know, part of your intellectual property and not have it get, you know, ripped off by someone who's doing it in a much cheaper way, using cheap labour in another part of the world?
It's always difficult. I mean, in terms of just the simplicity of having a bag that sits in the frame triangle, it was done 100 years ago. It's impossible to patent as such. You know, how could you possibly patent that? In terms of individual designs for patenting our gear, again, it's very, very difficult. And for anybody that's actually done any research in this, a patent is essentially a piece of paper, an expensive piece of paper. And to actually protect it, you then still have to go to solicitors. I mean, the Wildcat gear, we've been making this gear for long enough that people recognise it as our gear now. Now we're starting to come out into the mainstream. People are seeing it more. But, I mean, I've spoken to a lot of the competition. You know, they do what they do, I do what I do. And I think to a certain extent, we respect what each other's do. My gear started as sort of handmade in the UK. We're completely with that idea. Everything is handmade in the UK. But what I've done is the standard item fits, which would be a mountain lion handlebar harness, ocelot frame bag, and the tiger seat harness, are basically outsourced to a UK company. So they are still made in the UK, but I don't have to make them myself, which means I've got time to focus on the custom frame bags and custom orders and research more products as well. But we've trademarked Wildcat. People know our gear. And if you look on any of the forums and researchers, people love our gear, and our customers speak for ourselves. You just research and see what people say about us.
Another aspect of the bikepacking world that I think is quite interesting is the kind of make your own gear side of things, that people are experimenting with their own stuff and, you know, maybe making something that's inspired by one of your products. What do you think of that? And what advice would you give to people who are, you know, getting out the sewing machine and having a go themselves?
Wildcat Gear started as a make your own gear. I wanted to start a job at home that fitted around my family. It's just taken off from there. But yeah, make your own gear is brilliant. People are doing it. Top tips for make your own gear: buy a really old treadle sewing machine. Forget any of the modern stuff. If you want to use the really hard wearing materials, the modern sewing machines don't cut it. So like my old Singer, this VX material, my 200 quid mum's sewing machine, nah, didn't stand a chance. My 100-year-old sewing machine, yeah, that can sew it. I can still sew a frame bag on that old machine. Other top tip, avoid pins in Velcro. They really, really hurt. Bulldog clips are the way to go for pinning up, you know, securing it as to where you go.
And that's good advice. Terrific. And so will you always stay as a British made and designed company? You know, if you have a growth strategy, does that include scaling up to a point where you're going to have to go to China or Bangladesh or wherever?
UK all the way. The feedback I get is, we love your kit because it's UK made.
I was talking to Beth Barrington of Wildcat Gear, and a couple of months after we spoke, she went and won the Best in Show award for cycle accessories at the Bespoked Handmade Bicycle Show. So congratulations to Beth, and I'm very grateful to her for the loan of some of her excellent kit that I used in the Bare Bones winter event. Well, that's it for this edition of The Bike Show. Thanks for listening. I'm sure we'll be returning to bikepacking in 2016. If you've got any burning bikepacking questions, send them in. I can try and find an expert answer You can contact me, bikeshow@resonancefm.com, or via Twitter @JackThurston or @TheBikeShow. Thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye.